Welcome to Season 2 of the Y87 Podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. In this podcast, we will be talking to members of the Yale alumni community about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We will be exploring what they've learned, how they see the world, and what they dream of the future. This podcast is devoted to the idea that every life is remarkable. So we will be speaking to a wide spectrum of classmates and friends, exploring as many perspectives as we can. We hope you enjoy the podcast and it gives you something to think about. If you're a new listener, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. As you listen, please think about acknowledging the generosity of our guests in sharing their lives. Leave a comment, tell a friend, sign up to be a guest yourself. We'd love to hear what you think. Now, sit back and enjoy today's conversation. We hope you enjoy it. And welcome to the next edition of the Y87 Podcast. With me today is Rob Raguso. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
I am good. Thanks for joining in today. Where are you and what are you up to?
Yeah, I'm in chilly Ithaca, New York, where I am a professor at Cornell University. I'm married with two grown kids. One is a 3D video designer, and the other is a humanities major at the University of Chicago.
Very exciting. So I was looking up your Wikipedia page, because not all of our classmates have a Wikipedia page, but you do. And it labels you as an American biologist. Is that what you are? Is that how you see yourself?
What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
First of all, disclosure, I didn't write the Wikipedia page. This was written for me by a friend and colleague. I think he intended that I'm a biologist from the United States of America, but that's not how I see it. So much of my own personal history and education and inspiration derive from all of the Americas, Latin America, Deep South America, Canada. And so my personal life and my growth as a scientist and a lot of what I've studied are about the hemisphere, about the Americas writ large. So yeah, I'm an American biologist in that sense. And I think among my ilk, you know, ecologists and evolutionary biologists, there's a fair agreement that you can't really study the biota and the history of our continent or continental United States without a deeper understanding of Mexico and the Great American Interchange between North and South America through Panama, you know, during geological time. So that's the kind of American biologist I am.
Got it. And so you're just a little, let's unpack a little bit what you just talked about. You mentioned evolutionary biology and understanding the interplay between the South and North America. How does, because, you know, obviously we were roommates, so I know you are into moths, butterflies, and all things to do with bugs. Like, how do you go from studying bugs and butterflies to these huge themes you just encapsulated in your last answer?
Yeah, that's that's a great question. That's what have you done with your life question? You know, I grew up as a collector. My dad and mom collect glass, and my dad was a merchant marine, and he taught me about the stars, you know, how to navigate. And I was a natural history collector as a kid. So when I came to Yale, I knew a lot about butterflies and dinosaurs and things like that. And I had met a Yale professor, Charles Remington, when I was a teenager, somebody who kind of founded the study of butterflies in the United States. So I came to Yale wanting to be the, you know, the best butterfly biologist I could. But I realized I wasn't a scientist yet. I was a collector. And a lot of my education was about becoming a scientist and asking the question, can I make a living doing this? I have a lot of enthusiasm and love for nature, but that's not quite what a scientist is, right? That's only part of the equation. So a large part of my early education, graduate school, et cetera, was trying to ask the question, can I become a scientist? Can I use the knowledge and the passion and the interest that I have to actually frame and answer scientific questions? You know, what I learned early is if you're interested in butterflies and moths and other insects, largely you're interested in plants because they, you know, plants provide all the niches, all of the living space, all of the reason for the raison d'etre for insects really is plants and plant parts and plant chemistry. And then the question is, what level of analysis do you want to work on? Do you want to ask how things work and study genetics and biochemistry and endocrinology? Or do you want to understand, you know, how they evolve? What are the patterns you see out in the world? You know, why are there yuccas and cactus, you know, in the desert in North America, but those same plants are not in Africa, which has plenty of desert. And you start asking questions globally as to like, why do, you know, what are the distribution and abundance of organisms? That's ecology, at least the non-demographic part. So to make, you know, the short answer is, you know, lots of people grow up interested in the natural world and some of them retain it as a hobby. You know, my big decision point on graduating college was, do I do this as a hobby and do and choose something else as a profession, or do I follow this through as an academic scientist? And I did the latter.
How do you decide what to study? I mean, you've just mentioned like five things in the last answer. Like, yeah. How do you say, I'm going to go after the cactus, or I'm going to look at the, you know, I just remember your PhD study. And like, if I remember correctly, why did two species in the same genus pollinate differently?
Yeah. So that's a good question. People are motivated. Scientists, you know, are kind of self-conscious nonconformists, to use a term that one of my other roommates, Rich Dietz, taught me. And they never want to be in a club that would have them. You know, they always run in the opposite direction and want to be really original. I think I'm really drawn to, I draw my inspiration from the natural world. I'm really interested in complexity and diversity. I think the right word in psychology would be neophilia, someone who loves novelty and new things. I don't think xenophilia is a word, but it's the opposite of xenophobia is what I'm all about. And I'm really interested in new things and different things. And that's true outside of science too. I like different kinds of music and food and cultures and I like to travel. But as a scientist, I draw my inspiration from the natural world. So it starts with a field trip. I need to see things for myself. And I don't want to be biased by what's in the literature. You know, I had a lot of anxiety as a grad student and sort of imposter syndrome about like, you know, look at all the journals and books in the library. How can I ever contribute to the knowledge? And then the Zen approach is to throw that out, just go out in nature and see things and then ask, what did I just see? Is it interesting? Is it new? Is it trivial? Talk to people about it. So what do? I go and make observations and then I go check on it and say, have I observed something strange or unusual? And does it fly in the face of theory? If so, that's really interesting. That's worth following up on. My professors always taught me to find the gaps. Find the gaps in theory, something that's not explained well. I'll give you one. People who study agricultural pests, why do certain bugs eat plants? And how do you protect the plants from getting eaten by bugs? They tend to focus on chemistry, the chemistry of the leaves, toxins, things that that prevent, you know, bugs from defoliating plants, like nicotine and tobacco, for example. But people who study pollination historically were really fascinated or fixated on color. You know, flowers are so compellingly colorful. And yet some of the same insects are, their caterpillars are eating leaves and they only care about chemistry and their adults are only kind of care about color. You know, so optimal foraging theory, for example, is only about calories and sugar and nectar, but nectar's full of stuff. Nectar is full of drugs and salts and amino acids, lots of things that have nothing to do with or complement, you know, the caloric value of nectar. So as a grad student, one of the gaps I found was people don't study perfume. Perfumers study perfume, but they don't want you to know what's in it because they're making a lot of money, right? Biologists don't study perfume because they don't know the chemistry. So I thought, what if I study what's new under the sun? Is that pollination is this multi-billion dollar important, you know, ecological interaction that provides food security and ecosystem services to humanity. And you know, 80% of all plants need insects or animals to pollinate them. 2/3 of our crop plants, all that stuff. And yet nobody is asking how the chemistry of flowers, their fragrances, their nectars, you know, allow pollinators to make decisions. So you could drive a truck through that gap. And I've spent my whole career occupying that gap. It's not closed. So, you know, I like discovery. I don't like crowds. I have colleagues in science who just like want to study the hottest topic, you know, genomics, gene editing. They want to be there. And it's really crowded. And there's a lot of hurly-burly. I would rather be alone on the frontier seeing something new with the chance to maybe be the first person to describe it and convey that to the rest of the world.
What I find really interesting, though, is you keep saying, you've said it now like 3 or 4 times, I want to find something new, but you're actually studying things that are ancient. And well, no, it's fascinating because it's just whether or not, you know, right now we actually understand this stuff. And I know that you've spent a lot of time you know, in remote places, in the Amazon and places like that, any of your interactions, you know, have you found it that your, you know, modern eye or modern science is discovering something that the ancients knew about thousands of years ago, or at least understood implicitly?
Yeah, totally. This is a really great point. I feel a lot of humility in what I do. As you know, I was not a great chemist, and we can come back to that at some other point in this conversation. I don't think there's anything that I've done that people haven't seen before. You know, one of the things you realize early on in working outdoors is that people who live and work on the land, ranchers, farmers, folks who live in rural environments, they know nature really well. They see it every day. It's often really important to their livelihoods. And so I work in rural America. I work in the developing world. The first thing I learned was talk to people about what they know, be humble, write down a lot of notes, work with them, talk to them. Don't show up in a parachute from the Ivy League and act like you know what you're seeing. So that's the first part of the answer. The second is, you're right. I mean, human society has been interested in perfume as long as there's been history, you know, and a lot of that information is lost when we ransack and burn libraries, et cetera. But I think, you know, if you've asked me, well, what have you done? Maybe I've rediscovered some, you know, basic knowledge that was hiding in plain sight, but I've been able to put it into an ecological framework, or I've been able to put it into a context or a frame of reference that people can understand without it being through only one cultural prism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, it completely makes sense. Now, you mentioned your chemistry story, so I have to go there.
Yeah.
You know, like you're a fixture. There are a couple different classmates who've been the subject of inspiration in our household, and you're one of them. Let's say you didn't do particularly well in organic chemistry, as I remember the story. It's a longer story, and I know it was a deep disappointment. I remember it when it happened, but you overcame it. And I find it ironic that you struggled so mightily with organic chemistry in college and yet ended up teaching it. So, like, right. How did you overcome that? I mean, like, not quite a close to failing grade in organic chemistry would have completely shattered someone's career aspirations. Yeah. And it didn't shatter you. I mean, it wasn't pleasant, but you got through it. Yeah. How'd you do that? And how did that, like, looking back on it, define you as a scientist and inform the way you interact with your students?
Yeah. No, thanks for digging that up. But let's begin.
I think it's an inspiration.
No. Yeah, sure. But let's begin by saying that I was 20. And it was sort of a catastrophic year of decision-making for me. And I've got a little note on my whiteboard in my office now saying, you know, forgive. You know, my students are 20, my daughter's 20. You know, I kept a diary. I know what a butthead I was. I've forgiven myself. So that's number one, that it was a year of learning and hard lessons for me. You know, number two, you know, Harry Wasserman, rest his soul, was a really innovative and passionate teacher. It's a shame that I didn't respond well to that class. And it may have more to do with the kind of competitive atmosphere in the class than Harry himself. But we had a really memorable confrontation. You know, I had an awful average going into the final. And, you know, your wonderful wife suggested to me, hey, you know, go talk to Harry. He's great. And I walked into his room and he gave me like a face full of tough love. You know, he was not great. He called me out. He questioned my manhood. You know, he basically said, you suck. You're never going to amount to anything. You should drop the course. You're wasting my time. And he played me like a fiddle. Like, he knew what I'd do. I'll show you, you know, you bastard. I'll go home and study. You know, I got a 96 in the final and I tromped into his office and showed him, and he got so angry that, like, he threw me up to the board and said, do this, you know, show me a Grignard reaction, you know, do that. And I had it all, right? I was like Voldemort, just knocking down Harry Potter's spells. And he looked at me and he said, how dare you? How dare you wait till the end of a class to show your potential? You could have been the best student in this class. I'll do something you'll never forget. I'll give you a D anyway. Get out of my office. You make me sick. He did that. I had to swallow that D. And I had to make a decision. That's the long walk home to my dorm. Like, do I stay here and take this course again in the summer? Or do I go to Mexico and take this job that I just got, which has the potential to transform my whole life? You know, so I swallowed the D and I went down to Mexico and I had my life changed. So how it changed me as a scientist in two ways. One, it made me think more strategically, but certainly I never got a D again in anything. That was so painful that I just resolved never again. So it gave me a sense of, it just demanded that I show agency in my own actions. And the other is that as a scientist, Tim, you have to experience failure. You know, I know we have a lot of classmates who've like started their own companies and made fortunes and taken real risks and experienced failure and then said, well, piss on it. I'm going back and doing it again. And that's hard to learn if you don't have the personality. But in science, if you're not trying something on the cutting edge and getting your grant rejected 9 out of 10 times because people don't believe it, that it could be important or interesting or real, then you're not really trying, right? And also, if you publish your work in safe journals and you don't get it rejected, then you're not trying to reach the broadest audience. So I take that lesson. You know, as a teacher, it challenged me to think about how to reach students with diverse learning styles and personalities. You know, we'll talk later about maybe a little bit about art history and why it's so important to me. I just remember Vincent Scully always talking about empathy and association. So I wasn't learning organic chemistry well in lecture course, but in the lab, I was really good at chromatography. It's something I do now. I'm an expert at. I teach it around the world in workshops. I love chromatography. So when it came time to teach chemical ecology, which is my field at Cornell, I thought, well, you know, here's the interesting thing. Literature is full of examples of fragrance and smells triggering memories and emotions, right? There's a famous quote from Proust about the Madeleine cookies and the childhood and the grandmother. So for me, when I finally learned organic chemistry as a grad student, and particularly in learning mass spectra, it was like learning kanji. It was like learning a language. You know, I wasn't good at pushing electrons around, but I could memorize and recognize like hundreds of mass spectra. That is how it clicked for me. And I thought, if I could connect that to experience and memory and emotion, my students will remember it. So what I do is like wine tasting. I give students sniffing vials with chemicals that have the same carbon skeleton, but one functional group is different or one atom is different. And then I ask them to sniff it and to confer with each other and then to tell me what it smells like. So I am connecting chemical structure and organic chemical principles to their personal experiences through simile. And then there's a reveal at the end. And they never forget that. And for me, it's super fun. And for the neuroscience students in our class, they realize, oh, I need to study the amygdala. I need to study the link in the brain between the olfactory system and the emotional system and the memory, you know, and the way that we store memories. So that was a long answer. But for me, that's a lifetime of making lemonade out of a really sour lemon. And it's worked out okay.
Yes, it definitely has. Showed a lot of resilience too. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you are enjoying the conversation. As you listen, please think about acknowledging the generosity of our guests for sharing their lives. Leave a comment, tell a friend, post about what you've heard on social media. Maybe sign up to be a guest yourself. The discussions we have on this podcast are made all the richer with your participation. Now, back to the conversation. You know, you mentioned art history, which is interesting to me because you not only majored in science, but then you had a minor at Yale in art history, as I remember it. Mm-hmm. So what humanities classes do you think every STEM student should be taking? And conversely, what STEM classes do you think humanities students should be taking?
Yeah, isn't that a wonderful open-ended question? You know, art history for me brought everything together. You know, the best class, if you were going to ask me or not, the most impactful class I ever took at Yale was by Mary Ellen Miller, The Art and Architecture of Mesoamerica. You have to understand, I had just come back from Mexico. I was still 20. and Mary Miller at that time was this amazingly brilliant young woman, you know, master of her field. She had just written this book about the Bonampak murals and of the Maya. Her class was everything. It was history. It was geography. It was Spanish and Nahuatl and linguistics. And she was just at the top of her game. I was enthralled. And it brought together all of my interests. And then I took other art history classes. I took Japanese art history with Carolyn Wheelwright, who unfortunately, you know, passed the year after the course. But that was a brilliant class. And I took Scully. But you know, for me, those classes you know, I couldn't major in humanities and in history, but I was interested in all those things. And art history kind of brought it together. Religion, literature, history, who made the art, who paid for it, who got to see it, what are the hidden themes in there? You know, where do the pigments come from? There's all these stories, right, hidden in the, and then of course also the medium is important too. So I mean, that's what worked for me. You know, 30 years, 35 years later, you know, I'm an educator, I'm a citizen. I'm really upset at kind of the forces kind of ripping our country apart. And I'm a teacher and I'm trying to model good citizenship and, you know, evidence-based, you know, lifestyle to my students without talking about, you know, political things in front of them. And so I think for my non-science students, I think that I'd like them to understand the major forces in science that are changing our society. One of them is big data. You know, I don't know what the best classes are to understand how, you know, statistically, you know, social scientists and genomics scientists are using huge data sets. But that's a huge revolution. If you don't have a STEM background, you've got to understand at least where that's coming from. And I would say along with that, even without the last few years, I would have said this anyway, epidemiology. I mean, this is the great moment for public health. We have an award-winning course at Cornell called People and Plagues for non-majors, non-scientists. And I think that that's really important in our moment to understand this has happened iteratively in human history. It's shaped human history. It'll happen again. How do we know what we know? And that's the link to what would I ask my science students to take outside of sciences. I think ethics is really important, and really especially now. I think epistemology and philosophy, how do we know what we know? There's a lot of arrogance among some scientists about what they think they know without understanding philosophical underpinnings of that. I think debate and theater are really important because they force you to get out of your own head. Catherine Slusar just described this beautifully in her podcast. But I think debate as a discipline to be forced to prepare and defend ideas that you don't hold, that changes you, right? You're not going to be a blowhard when you're done with that. You're going to listen. You're going to ask twice about your own assumptions and what you believe in. You know, I mean, for me, that happened by doing exchange trips and living in other people's countries and speaking their languages and being a guest. You know, I lived in Chile during the end of the Pinochet, you know, dictatorship. That was an incredible education for me. Things I could say, things I couldn't say. Learning to become fluent in Spanish and being a guest, you know, being treated extremely well by a country who didn't necessarily need or want to treat Americans well. So I guess that's the answer I'd give you. The arts are so important, not only to our mental health and to a rounded being, but also to scientists. You know, the science has a kind of sense of runaway prerequisites. You know, for science majors, there's always more you can do. But without writing and reading fiction and literature and without music, it's pretty dry. I need to do those things when I am grinding, you know, and I need a break from science. And then I always come back refreshed.
So, you know, you bring this curiosity and wonder to the world, but yet I imagine that, I see it because I have high school, college age, and just out of college age kids, you know, and I see how much kids have to grind to get to top institutions. And so sometimes the wonder and the curiosity has either been beaten out of them or they've been taught to suppress it to get the grade, to get the check the box. Do you find yourself having to teach wonder and curiosity to your students, or is that something that comes out naturally?
That's a great question. You know, as a teacher and as a parent, I think a lot about things I can teach and things I can't teach, but I can model. It's hard to teach empathy. It's hard to teach passion. It's hard to teach curiosity, but those are things you can really model. So I start with my students by modeling it every day. I get excited about stuff and I share it. It doesn't matter if it's important or trivial. If it's something new, you know, and I'm really jazzed about it, I'll say, hey, come and look at the microscope. I want to show you something. Would you believe that these little yellow flowers are covered with these little Q-tips and that what bees do is they whack them and break them open and then they ooze oil and then they drink all that and bring it back to their young? If you just looked at this flower, you wouldn't see that. And then I encourage students, especially young ones, you know, summer undergraduates who are just visiting my lab for a few weeks, to devote part of every day to exploring. You know, so some of what they have to do is I compel them to keep a lab notebook as a diary. because you forget things or you edit history later, which is really bad. But to draw and to take photos and to just fill that book. And then I encourage them on their way to lab or on their way home, just stop and explore something. And we have a beautiful campus at Cornell. You know, in the summertime, it's full of gardens. Just go watch these big carpenter bees robbing flowers. You know, they do a Dracula on the backside of a tubular flower. They don't pollinate them at all. And it's like, whoa, what are they doing? That's not mutualistic, you know? And then we come talk about it. You know, the bigger thing, Tim, is that, you know, science isn't a neutral undertaking, right? We're storytellers and we build narratives. All successful scientists are really good at telling stories and compelling people to be interested in what they do. Jodie Foster did such a great job of this in the movie Contact, right? Where she had to get funding to communicate with the beings out in Vega. And I have colleagues in paleontology, the field that is very poorly funded. And what's cooler and sexier than studying dinosaurs? So I try to persuade my students to build their own narratives. You know, if you study science historically, you see that there are these narratives that hold sway and they're political and they're cultural. And you have to analyze it that way too. But the beauty of data is that, you know, at the end of the day, you have to trust the numbers. So I also try to model that kind of transparency in our lab. I'll give you an example. We do a lot of double blind data collection and analysis. And I'm not studying things that are going to change public policy like cancer biology, but nevertheless, we want all of our science to be really transparent and, you know, and trustworthy. So, you know, I show our undergraduates, like, we're going to collect data and someone else in the group is going to analyze the data. And then we're going to give all the variables, you know, funny names so nobody knows what they are. And then we're going to have one big lab meeting where there's a big reveal and we figure out what the outcome of the experiment was. And so that gets everybody to buy in that it's a group activity and that they understand that Professor Raguzzo isn't just collecting data that's going to support his next grant proposal or allow him to, you know, get one over on his colleague from Switzerland or whatever. Instead, it's like, let's respect the data. Let's see what we've got. And until the end, don't cook the books, right? Don't peek. And then that's really nice. Whatever they end up getting out of the summer or their time with me, they end up understanding that it doesn't matter how important you think the science is, that these are best practices, right?
So, you know, how has scientific collaboration changed since 35 years ago when we emerged into the world? Has it changed fundamentally, or is technology helping it, hurting it, or is it culturally the same?
Oh, it's changed enormously. That's a really great, pertinent question. I can tell you a few different ways that it's changed. One is demographics, right? Our professors some of them were World War II veterans. Some of them were baby boomers. All of them got jobs out of grad school without doing postdocs. So they were really entitled. They staked out long-term questions. It was their identity. They spent their whole careers working on African Rift Valley cichlid fish or Galapagos finches or something. And then, you know, and nobody challenged them, right? And they did a lot of begetting, right? They had a lot of grad students. There were a lot of books. They always got their grants renewed. And then one day everybody woke up and realized, oh, we made a lot more scientists in the world, but the NSF budget's pretty flat. At some point when I became, you know, a professor, there was a big culture shift in the funding agencies of like, yeah, you know what? You don't get to do everything forever anymore. Every new grant now in NSF, at least, National Science Foundation, is sui generis. It's its own thing. It's you know, it's a new idea. And if it's not a good one, it doesn't matter how well you did on the last grant. You're not getting funded. So there's a demographic push to drive scientists with complementary skills together into teams. And that's really great because then you develop with your students in real time all these soft skills about how to collaborate, how to communicate well, early on about what roles are, how to kind of diffuse power structures in those teams, how to make data freely available to the public. We archive everything now. You can't publish anything without uploading your data sets, which is great. Now somebody could run the stats on your data and say, you know what? As they're reviewing your paper and say, you know what? You missed this. This is an ANCOVA instead of an ANOVA. Do it again. So there's that. There's another part, though, that I think is really important. You know, I mentioned I spent a lot of time in Latin America, but also elsewhere, South Africa, lots of parts of the developing world. And one of the big problems in science until recently has been kind of colonial science, right? Indiana Jones science. Like, you know, you go in, you're dashing, you discover something new, and you go home. Hiram Bingham, you know, no offense to Hiram Bingham, the guy who quote unquote discovered Machu Picchu. He was a Yale guy, right? But Machu Picchu was there. You know, he didn't discover it. You know, Columbus didn't discover the New World. So what I started doing as a young scientist, and this comes from living in Latin America and being a guest and really just feeling incredibly indebted to my friends and colleagues there, is writing collaborative grants to like National Geographic or Fulbright and setting in stone these long-term collaborative projects with my colleagues in Argentina and South Africa and their students, and repatriating like the specimens. Like, they have the biodiversity that we don't. They have great museums and collections, and they have the brain power. My colleagues in all those countries are incredible because they have fewer resources than we do, and they work harder and they're more resilient. So for me, that kind of collaboration is incredibly rewarding because it's co-equal. I visit, I'm a guest, we do stuff together. You know, we write the papers up, the specimens stay there as their patrimony, you know, and I come home. And that builds trust. You know, that didn't happen before. When I graduated from Michigan, I actually repatriated all the insect specimens I'd ever collected from other countries to those original countries. And it's all published, they're all documented. I feel really good about that. It was a nice sense of closure before becoming a professor and moving on.
So we've gotten to the part of the podcast we call the lightning round. So I have a couple different questions for you. Let's see how we do here. If you were to bring back one piece of fashion from your youth, 60s, 70s, or 80s, I don't remember a lot about the 60s, but I see the pictures, you know, what would it be?
Not leisure suits. Or dashikis. I'm thinking early 80s, Joe Jackson leather ties, or ZZ Top stick pins from Sharp Dressed Man. There we go.
All right. Fair enough. I like that. I like that. I was thinking like the plaid bell bottoms or something like that, but
no.
Yeah. Best left to memory and pictures. Okay. Mm. True or false? You can take the boy out of New Jersey, but you can't take New Jersey out of the boy.
Get out of here. Stop busting my chops.
Oh, you know, it's funny because I always think of you from college as, you know, firmly rooted in New Jersey with the food you talked about and the cultural, the Sunday dinners you told us about and whatnot. And then, you know, you're truly a man of the world. You've been to all sorts of places. It's sort of funny.
Yeah. You know, no, New Jersey pride. Okay. New Jersey is a really special place. There's nothing that I can say that Bruce Springsteen hasn't said eloquently. It's just a strange combination of small town America in the shadow of two great cities. And I think maybe there's a little insecurity that comes from that, which kind of gives a lot of New Jerseyites a little bit of attitude and chip on their shoulder. But yeah, what can I tell you? You got to love where you're from. It shapes you.
It does.
It shapes you. And we had a lot of Jersey, you know, a lot of Jersey friends from our class. So
absolutely. Absolutely. So final question. If you were going to come back as a butterfly, which one would you want to be?
Jeez. Well, this is a really geeky, I know too much, right? I think I'd be a monarch, and let me explain my answer. Number one, as you know, monarchs are chemically defended and they have very leathery, rubbery bodies. So they're much more likely to survive attacks by predators than almost all other butterflies. Number two, they have adventure. You know, so many butterflies, checker spot butterflies, famously, you know, studied by Paul Ehrlich at Stanford, never leave where they're born, right? They're home bodies. Monarchs embark on these fabulous voyages across continents and end up in the mountains of southern Mexico. And then they get to come back. And when I lived in South Carolina before moving to Cornell, we used to find the bedraggled monarchs in March of the next year, you know, just like crawling along the ground in the swamp, in the Congaree swamp. Much respect, right? I would just sort of kneel in honor in front of that monarch and say, "You made it." You made it. Then you have all of these phony monarchs, right? Viceroys and other mimics that want to be like you, want to look like you, you know, dress up like you. So yeah, I'm going with the monarch. How about that?
I think that is an excellent answer and a great place to end our talk today. Thank you so much for taking the time. It was great to catch up.
Thank you, Tim. You know, you do a great job with these, and it's an honor for me to be a part of it. I love what you've done, and I'm really looking forward to the reunion.
Yes.
I want to be there.
Sounds good.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while. An in-person reunion, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022. We will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. One Yale College class dared to break the mold. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.